You're listening to member-supported Public Radio 90, WNMU-FM Marquette, online at WNMUFM.org, broadcasting from the campus of Northern Michigan University. And I mention that because we have a special guest in the studio today who's also a member of the NMU family and part of the Learning Resources Center at the Archives on campus. We have Mr. Marcus Robbins to tell us a little bit about the next Evening at the Archives event. Hello, Marcus.
Hi, Kurt. How you doing?
I'm good.
Thanks for having me on. This is great.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have another Evening at the Archives coming up that is one of those special events that highlights things happening in the archives.
Mm-hmm.
And also this time features some other youth that are involved with the process of finding out some information about our area. What could you tell us about that?
Well, our evening programs are designed to highlight archival collections and also the research that's going on. You know, what people are doing and giving them an opportunity to present that research. And in this case, it's very exciting. We've got two high school seniors, Lucas Lambertson and Chaz Blues, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, who are seniors at Nagani High School, and they are in Andy Skewis's English class there. And as part of a class project, they did research in the archives last semester on the 1946 iron miners' strike in the Marquette Iron Range, and they have produced a documentary video about that strike, and we'll be presenting it and talking about that and the process and what they learned at the archives.
So why is this an event that is featured, and not just the Evening at the Archives, why is the strike of 46 an important event to our area, and why was this something that needed to be kind of digged into a little bit?
Well, you know, outside of the immediate area, not a lot of people remember the strike of 1946, but it was probably one of the most single important events of the 20th century in the Upper Peninsula. It brought in and established industrial unionism in the Upper Peninsula. After a dry spell of over 50 years of union labor activity, the last strike that occurred on the Marquette Iron Range prior to 1946 was in 1899, and it failed. And then the very, really big strike of 1895 that actually resulted in the state militia coming in and crushing the strike, that happened in 1895. And in that 50-year period, there was nothing. There was no labor activity or organizing going on. The Congress of Industrial Organizations sent in organizers from Duluth in 1937, soon after the passage of the Wagner Act, which legalized unionization in the United States. And they began organizing workers on the range. They were successful, and by 1943, the United Steelworkers of America, which had formerly been the Steel Workers Organizing Committee of the Committee for Industrial Organizations, actually negotiated the first contract with the iron mining companies. And of course, that was during the war. And labor took, they agreed to controls on salaries and wages during the war to keep inflation down. And as a result, made very little of the money that corporations made big time during the war, huge profits both in plant and assets and equipment, and in just in the production of what they were doing. And after the war, labor across the United States on all the major industries began to demand a share of that profit. So that by 1946, in February of 46, most of the major industries, they went on strike. That's another thing people don't remember. Hmm. Railroad, oil, you know, steel industry across the board.
Infrastructure of the country.
Oh, yeah, went on strike, demanding a share. The steel industry, the workers were demanding 18.5 cents per hour in increase in wages. Now, today, that's not very much. And even then, that still wasn't very much and wasn't certainly going to really recoup for workers what some of the profits that corporations made during the war. But and in the steel industry itself, in the cities, you know, where the big mills were, they negotiated and agreed to that increase pretty quickly, within 2 weeks. And there's a lot of background, you know, story there going on with the role of the federal government and so forth. The iron mining companies, however, refused to accept the 18.5 cents an hour, and they held out. And so, nationally, the steel industry, the strike ended within 2 weeks after it started on February 8th, 1946. But here, the strike in the iron mining companies and the iron mines lasted well into May.
Wow.
So nearly 5 months. And it was pretty long and stressful and taxing both on both sides. But what's really fascinating to me about this strike was the degree to which the community supported the strikers. And I mean, it's across the board. One of the fascinating things is that the elements of authority, both the government and the police, were very supportive of the strikers for the most part. Mm-hmm. The state refused to intervene with the state militia. The mayor of Nagani and the chief police of Nagani were both indicted in court for obstruction of justice by the labor. You know, they were basically sued by the iron mining companies because they refused to allow the police force from intervening and also actively supported the. And I have a great photograph of the mayor of Nagani and this chief of police standing with a bunch of striking miners. Mm-hmm. That was unheard of. I mean, usually in the United States, the elements of authority in the middle class and the professional class is sided with the corporations in strikes of this nature. So that was pretty amazing. And then the different professional business associations, the Chamber of Commerce, has raised a lot of money. Over $10,000 to support the strikers. I mean, when I found out about that, read that, I was just stunned.
Yeah,
so there was a lot of support for the striking miners. And then there's a lot of evidence that women within the domestic sphere were also very directly supportive. Some people don't, people don't think about, when they think about a strike, they think about men on the picket line striking. Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. But there's the women and the domestic support in the background. These are the people that are doing all the work to support those strikers.
Right,
And there's evidence that families were actively on the picket lines during the 1946 strike. You can see photographs of them, children with handmade, not with professional, professionally made strike signs on the picket lines. And there's a story that about halfway through the strike, the mining companies began a back to work movement, quote unquote, which was basically bringing in scabs to try to break the strike, and failed because thousands of people would come out, literally streaming out of their houses. Mm-hmm. The union would, whenever the scabs would start to approach they were like armored. They looked like armored turtle buses. would start to approach the mines. The union would crank up this World War II. Well, it was just right after World War II air raid siren.
Oh, boy.
And you can imagine that going off, and the people would hear it. Now, remember, this was still the underground mining period, and so these mines were literally within a couple of blocks of where the miners worked. So families would just rush out by the hundreds and go to where the mine was and just surround these.
I'm seeing a blockade.
Yeah, and I've got some great photographs in the archives where you just see just literally thousands of people around these buses, and it's just. And for a strike that lasted so long, it didn't really, it wasn't that violent, which is really fascinating to me. There were some instances of intimidation. A couple of supervisors' cars were turned over. Nobody was injured, except there was one instance of a scab or a worker or miner who went across the picket lines having shot at a striker, but apparently didn't hit the person. But that was the only incidents that I've seen of any kind of, where a firearm went off or something like that.
Right, but tempers flared.
Yeah. There was, the legal injunctions back and forth. But another thing that happened during the strike that was really very fascinating to me is Paul Robeson showed up. Now, I know there's probably only a few people. In the 22 years I've told this story, I've had one student tell me who he knew who Paul Robeson was. Well, in 1946, Paul Robeson was an enormously famous, internationally famous singer, Broadway singer, star in the movies. He was an African-American. He's best known for his rendition of Old Man River from Porgy and Bess.
Okay.
He had that very deep, baritone bass voice.
Right.
And But he was fabulously popular around the United States. And he was doing a, he had started a concert tour in the fall of 1945. And the Quall Family Enterprises brought him, commissioned him to come to Nagani, I mean to Ishpeming, I'm sorry, to give a performance at the Public Auditorium as part of his concert tour.
Sure.
And when the union found out about, because see, the thing is that Robeson, not only was he this famous entertainer, but he was also very left-wing, strong and public supporter of labor and of unions, a pioneer of the civil rights movement. He was reputed to be a communist, but no one ever has ever found the smoking gun, you know, that he was actually a communist.
Early Red Scare.
Right, early, yeah. And ironically, later, you know, in the, during the McCarthy period, he would be hauled before the House Un-American Activities Committee in Congress, and his career ruined, and he was basically had to flee into exile in London. But this was later. But in 1946, he's still this immensely popular. And he came and he drove out to one of the pickets. And actually, ironically, it was the Mather Mine, which is now the parking lot at the Nagani High School. And he got up on a sound car and he serenaded the striking workers and their families. And I have photographs of that and him with that. He even got on the union's radio show later that day. And he went around and talked to some civic groups trying to buck up the strikers. And so it's a really fascinating little vignette in the story.
Yeah.
You know, I remember when I first saw that photograph of him when I came here, I was just stunned because he's one of my personal historical figures, heroes. And I thought, Paul Robeson came to Nagani and Ishpeming? I was like, oh, my God.
That's enough of a shock factor to know you had this national fame.
Right.
And then all of a sudden he becomes this voice.
He became a voice for the strikers. Yeah. And, the late Ernie Ron, famous labor organizer, and district director for the USWA, told me that, Robeson's appearance was a big shot in the arm, really vitalized the strike because it was in April, late April when he arrived, and they were getting really drawn out, and it was just not
getting anywhere. Yeah, it'd been months into that.
Right, yeah.
Wow.
And then another side story is John Volker, who's famous, the famous author of Anatomy of Murder. He was the prosecuting attorney for Marquette County at the time, and he wrote an open letter in the Mining Journal demanding that the iron companies settle the strike with the workers. And he was, you know, vilified for that too. And it's possible it might have contributed to his losing the re-election for county prosecutor.
Sure. Well, now, and you'd mentioned too about how that was the former, the Mather is now the parking lot for the high school.
Right.
We can kind of segue into saying that we have these two students that are from the Nagani, it's from the Nagani
High School.
Yeah, and they're going to be taking part in the evening at the archives as well. How did they get involved?
Well, Andy Skewis, their teacher, he's an English teacher at the Nagani High School, reached out to me at some function over a year ago and said he was going to do this project and wanted to know if we had material on it. And I said, yeah, in fact, I've written an article, a presentation about this, very interested in the idea of community organizing and the history of that. I said, sure. And so last semester, they came to the archives, the two students, and did historical research with the material that we have in the archives on this event. And then they also interviewed me, and they've interviewed a number of other people, and they who remember the strike, and they've put together a documentary, a video documentary, and they're going to present that documentary at evening tomorrow and talk about how they did it and what they learned.
Yeah. So the event itself, when does that take place?
It's at 7 o'clock tomorrow evening, Thursday the 28th, and it's in the Hardin, we're now called the Hardin Hall, formerly the Hardin Learning Resources Center. It's the building with the library in it, and we're on the first floor, and it's room 126.
Excellent.
And we'll have cookies and coffee.
Yep, and it's a free event for the public.
Of course, yeah, it's a free event.
Excellent. And just a reminder, we're speaking with Marcus Robbins, who is from the NMU Archives, talking about Evening at the Archives, the strike of 46, and through our conversation, learning that there's a lot more than just one of those two-week strikes. This is an event that took quite a long time, and we also have high school students that have been involved in finding out more information and would like to present that at this event, too. So come out and support their research and support our history in the area, which also turned into national history as well for this strike of 46. Marcus, thank you so much for taking
the time.
You're welcome.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about this. Mm-hmm. It's a great story.